Was there a point, like, with the investigation where you felt like the police just, you knew they weren't believing you, and...
The detective told me he didn't hold you down, that's not rape.
If you continue to lie to me, this is about to go south. I do not believe you. I do not believe you at all. It is a crime to file that false report.
I was raped, and they told me I lied about it.
I've been working on this story for 4 years. I managed to gather more than 160 cases where alleged victims of sexual assault were turned into suspects.
Filing a false report is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable up to 1 year in jail.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And I'm also full of cold, so I hope my cold isn't too bad for you lovely listeners. I'll do my best. But with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of Criminal Minds.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and also on the casting team for Star Wars Jedi Survivor, the video game that just dropped that I'm so, so proud of. Coming to you live from Cayucas, California. So please pardon the sound here. I'm in a beach house with my newly graduated boys from high school. We're on a little holiday, but the sound is not super great. But
no,
I'm so happy, to be here.
Congratulations to you and your sons.
To the boys, and enjoy the beach holiday. I wondered how you pronounce that, so I'm glad that that you said it. Well, today we're going to be talking, by very popular request, about the Netflix show called Victim Suspect. And I know that many of you have watched it. And how do I know that? Well, you've messaged nonstop about, as soon as you've watched this show, some of you haven't even been able to watch the whole thing. You've had to stop and start because you've been so incensed.
Yeah.
And I completely understand why. And a big shout out to Miriam, one of our longtime listeners who has messaged us a lot and always posts all of our episodes. Mm-hmm. And she has a number of questions, and we will come back to Miriam's questions. But I also want to just shout out Inbor Lesner, who's a friend of Real Crime Profile, and she's also the editor of Victim Suspect. And you might recall that we did a couple of interviews, actually, with Inbal and with the director, Cecilia Peck, on Brave Miss World and also Seduced, Inside Nexium Cult. And we deconstructed those cases and shows. Well, this is Inbal's other show, which she was the editor on. And my goodness, I mean, I started tracking it after they went to Sundance and got a standing ovation when people saw Victim Suspect. And I really can understand why now. It's a 1 hour, 35 minute documentary. Please watch it. It is just so angry making. There are so many aspects to it that Jim and Lisa and I want to unpick for you. Really, it follows this incredible journalist, Rachel DeLeon, who basically wondered whether one or two cases that she saw where victims had reported sexual assault and then became the suspects, whether that was a national pattern or trend. And she started diving into cases and put a Google alert on and found 160 plus cases. We don't see all of those cases. We see a handful of them. We hear about Emma Mannion, and we're going to detail each of these cases for our listeners, but I just want to nutshell it. Mm-hmm. Emma Mannion, and she was 18 years old and reported a rape in November 2016, and she then very quickly became termed the suspect. And we will go into each case, but Megan Rondini was also a victim who reported rape in the early hours of July 2015. She was 20 years old, and she became the suspect. And then there was Diane Bourmio, who reported a stranger rape, that she was assaulted by a police officer who pulled her car over, and her father told her to report, and she did. And again, the same pattern happened, that she became a suspect. And with some of the cases, it wasn't just they became suspects, they actually went to prison.
Right.
And right. We hear about all of that, and it really is just this incredible journey that would just have you screaming and just so angry about what's going on. So who wants to kick us off? There, a number of the cases, but we will talk about others as well, because for me, I was really incensed by this, having set up the sexual offences section at New Scotland Yard and created a reporting system at various hospitals called Haven, sexual assault referral centres, for victims to go to if they didn't want to talk to the police. And then they could have a number of options of what they wanted to do, but they would be medically examined. They would have a support from a specialist officer, and they could decide what happened next in terms of whether they wanted to indeed report, whether they wanted their forensics to be processed. And I just feel, well, that's going back in time to the 2000s. And here we are in 2023 witnessing this, which just made me so angry to understand how women who are traumatized, particularly young women, and who are going to the police because they believe that they will understand their experience, they will investigate what happened, and they will treat them with dignity and respect. And that's not what we see. We see the complete opposite.
I was equally incensed when I saw this, because what happened is, in the cases that they highlighted, they did not conduct a legitimate investigation of the allegations. They made an assessment. They had an opinion that what these young women were saying was not true, and they never did a complete investigation. They literally turned the tables on these victims, treated them like suspects, lied to them, manipulated them, and then charged them with false reporting. This is an aberration of justice. This is the worst kind of aberration of justice. It's not just not doing your job. It is flipping your job and attacking the victim. And that is not what law enforcement is about. Clearly, these guys were too lazy or uneducated about the behavior of victims and all the corroborating information that they had. And what they did instead was put pressure on the victims and try to make them recant. Once they got a recantation, they then said, I'm going to arrest you because you made a false report. And that is bullshit. It's just complete bullshit.
Lisa, what did you think?
So what people should imagine, if they haven't seen the documentary yet, is that Rachel De Leon unearths all of the footage of these interrogations or these interviews that the law enforcement does with the victim who is trying to tell her story. And the lack of curiosity on the police's part to even question the people who she says raped her. They don't even question that. They barely have any. It's like they make up their mind before they start investing the case. Now, yes, we know that every victim who comes forward, yes, there has to be an investigation. There has to be cross corroboration. There has to be
an investigation, you know,
an investigation
of the allegations.
And you can't just say, well, we asked them if these two alleged offenders would come in and be interviewed, and they didn't want to, so we didn't pursue it. Like, what the fuck is that? What does that mean? I was completely baffled. And even the few alleged offenders who they do bring in, the police kind of baby spoon them their own story. Like, well, she was drunk and it was consensual, right? And then the alleged offender is like, yeah. You know, it is just unbelievable to watch. And I just want to shout out the Center for Investigative Reporting, which is where Rachel De Leon is from. This is a beacon on a hill. This is a nonprofit organization that their credo is the truth will not reveal itself. Without a dogged investigative young reporter, I mean, she is a very young reporter, literally with her little backpack on and her little KED sneakers, going door to door and knocking on doors, trying to go to police department trying to get people to talk to her, trying to get this these tapes, these recordings. And she's just, you know, she's cock blocked at every turn to not get the real information, you know. You got to just really hand it to them, because this is not easy. This is a nonprofit. They rely on, you know, the Lucy Packard Foundation, the MacArthur grants. I mean, they don't make any, you know, money off of doing this kind of reporting. It is very, very difficult to get these stories out to us. So that's my first reaction, I guess.
Well, thank you for your reaction. And yes, Rachel had put this together. It was actually pre the pandemic, had been investigating. And then obviously they realized that there was much more to this story. And so it was in 2020 that it was commissioned by Netflix. And then we had the pandemic. So she thought it would be upended. And I'm hoping we're going to hear from her,
right?
Because I've managed to speak with her, and she would love to talk with us about her dogged reporting. And fortunately, they did start shooting in 2021. So that's why we see these cases now. And my goodness, yes, the lack of investigation and professional curiosity, they're the things I always teach law enforcement about. And you might say things like, well, it's a training issue. But actually, for me, it goes much deeper than that. Yes, we know that there are police departments without sexual offences departments. But really, why are we so backward in things that we know? I mean, Jim, you and I have specialized in this area, and we know that you need specialist trained officers. My first degree in psychology, my dissertation was on the SOWIT officers. They were called chaperones in the Met. This was in 1997 and 1998, where we had specialist officers, and I reviewed them and the workloads and just the cases and the requirement for specialist sexual assault units, because we know about trauma and we know that you need specialist handling of cases. And I have to say, everything that I saw were male officers being really, well, it was bullying, actually. I'm just going to call it what it is, because to me, it was just bullying. And we know that young women, and let's just take the trauma out of it for a minute, but 16 to 26 year olds, if you've had no contact with police, you have a view that they are there to be truth and integrity and that they will investigate, and you're polite and you might accept authority and you might not challenge it. But when you're traumatized and you've had no sleep, and there you've got a police officer who you believe will say the right thing and do the right thing in your best interest, doing the exact opposite, but you don't know that after 3 days of questioning, whatever it might be, no sleep, and this person doesn't understand.
And the traumatic event, right?
Yes. And you're the one that then is being stigmatized and being told that we don't believe you, there are inconsistencies. And those inconsistencies, well, yes, we know that sometimes victims don't remember certain things, right? But what if you've got alcohol, or what if you've been drug raped? You're not going to remember these things.
Right.
So I think for me, the case when I was watching Emma Mannion, who was 18 years old, and she's trying to describe what happened, and she had gone to the hospital first of all, and 3 days later, she was asked to attend a formal interview. And she was polite, but she couldn't really remember much about these two men. And she talked about being taken to a gravel parking lot, and one putting her in the van and raping her, and the other guy stood outside and making sure no one came across them. And that's what she's saying. And the investigator, and I'm going to name him, Jared Ackridge, was saying to her that he saw inconsistencies, and he had footage of her kissing this guy, which he didn't. He didn't have footage of them kissing, and he didn't show it to her either. He just said that he had some footage, and then he told her that he didn't believe her and that she wasn't being honest with him. And she just wanted the questioning to stop. So she eventually just nodded her head.
Right.
Yeah.
But Laura, didn't he have footage actually of a totally different
couple? Yes, a totally different person.
Yes. Who did not resemble, not her. No.
And he must have known that, because she didn't. I mean, to our eyes, we see it on camera when Rachel actually gets a copy of this video. They don't look the same. They weren't wearing the same clothes. In my view, there's no way you could mistake Emma for the other lady that's on camera. And that tells me that he lied out and out.
What the technique that he used, that this detective used, is something that should be used on hardened criminals. to try to get them to see that there's no way around just telling the truth. It is not a mechanism to try to elicit a recantation from a victim. Victims have many different behavioral issues. And if you're not trained in sex crimes, then you would not know what those issues are. And inconsistencies and also feeling, uncertain and having, as you said earlier, if they were using alcohol and not remembering or blacking out certain parts, that doesn't mean that they're lying about being raped. What they're saying is, I clearly couldn't have given consent because I wasn't even capable of being conscious at the time. So instead of taking that into account, they're using that against the victim. And what they did, and this is the insidious part of it, they got them to believe that, look, if you just say it didn't happen, then, you know, this is all resolved and everybody's good and everything's great. So they just took it as an easy way out because they didn't want to continue being harassed by the police and being questioned as if they were the criminal. And it not being believed and not going after the guys who actually committed the rapes. So they said, okay, well, then maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it didn't happen. Okay, whatever. And then the cop takes what is an asinine step. After having cajoled and coerced them into saying, okay, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe I was wrong. I'm so confused. Then he says, we're going to arrest you for making a false report, which is just complete bullshit. Meanwhile, then they go and talk to some of the actual rapists who give them false statements, and they sure as hell don't friggin' get prosecuted. They don't even get fully investigated. And as you said earlier, Lisa, he asked the two guys if they wanted to give a statement, and they said no. Why does that mean that they are innocent and this woman who was raped is guilty? It makes no sense. They just want to clear the case, and this is the best way to get a stat and to get rid of a new rape allegation.
I mean, I just wonder if it's more than that, though, Jim. I have a thought about it, which I'll come back to, because this level of the mindset that's so entrenched of wanting to find her to be the problem, and yet to interview, not even to interview them, to go and speak to two guys and just say, oh, well, they didn't want to talk to me. Oh, well, you are the problem and I'm going to arrest you. It's a double issue because it's one, bullying her to not admit to it, but she just nodded her head. So to bully her to that level and then to say, I'm going to arrest you,
yeah,
and to tell her such a lie. For me, it's much more deep-seated than just clearing up cases. And that really bothers me. I'm going to come back to that because with Megan Rondini's case, and it was this case that Emma knew about, which is why she decided to plead. Well, Megan's case, she had reported in the early hours of July 2015. She was 20 years old, and she then was interviewed for 2 hours, and she didn't remember much. And you'll recall that originally she had an advocate sat with her who then, you know, you think, well, that's good, but then decides, oh, actually, I'm going to go off. And she just leaves her there.
Who couldn't have given a shit, by the way, when you watch that tape, the advocate is doing nothing.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't, she looks like she doesn't want to be there. She's not at all reading the room, reading how exhausted Megan is, reading Megan's body language. In fact, both of these women's that we're talking about were interrogated in the same room. You can see it's the same room. And both of them are freezing. Both of them are covering their bodies with their hands, covering their groin areas with their hands. Sorry.
Continue. No, I think they're very important observations, actually, Lisa. And yes, in my mind's eye, I just see the advocate sat there clutching her handbag, desperate just to leave the room. Everything about her body and her lack of engagement. And I tell you, if that's an advocate, my goodness, you know, victims don't stand a chance. But then you've got this sort of badgering from the police officer. She's questioned for a long time, and she explains that certain things she can't remember, and that she met this guy, TJ Bunn, who we then find out was 34 years old.
34. And
Yeah, 34, she was 20. So I just want everyone to think about that, that he's hanging out in this student bar. So who's he going to be surrounded by? And she does go back with him and he does end up raping her. No, I have no reason not to believe her account. And she wants to leave and she's looking around and she takes some money, $3 or something ridiculous. She's trying to get out of the, and you can see that the police officer's just not buying anything she's saying. And I just also want to say about that lack of engagement, when you can see that someone's just not believing anything that you're saying and you still cannot make sense of what's gone on. We see her trauma, we see her trying to make sense and her feeling everything's stacked against her. And then we find out that he does, 4 days later, interview the perpetrator, TJ Bunn. Well, it's not really an interview. It's an 18-minute sit-down, it by contrast. And it's a bit of a bro chat. They talk about fishing and so forth. And is all I keep thinking about is Brian Laundry and other cases I've worked where, you know, really you've just got a load of fist bumping and dudes chatting. And he clears up that it wasn't rape. He's actually filling in for him, giving his narrative for him, wasn't he? And he was sat there with his lawyer and he'd changed his account after he lawyered up. Everything about that is just red flag territory. And then we find out that Megan takes her own life after that. Yeah. And that for me, these are the cases we don't hear about the impact afterwards, do we, of this treatment by law enforcement. And it's just so angry making for her family, for her to A, have been victimized in this way, B, this was a family, TJ Bunn's family was a local, prominent, privileged, well-off, well-known family in the area. And she really never stood a chance.
Yeah, no way.
That power imbalance was so clear to me in that interview. And as you said, Lisa, her being cold and uncomfortable and shifting and saying that, why is it that you just believe his account? There seems to be everything stacked against me. She was so astute. Wasn't she? She understood that she was being seen as the problem.
Right. And when we meet her parents, I mean, the pain and the anguish and the suffering that you see that on their faces, it's just so clear. The fact that their daughter not only had to suffer the rape, but then to be re-victimized by the system. I mean, so extremely. And in a matter of just a few hours, they decide she is guilty of filing a false report. And they hand this guy, TJ Bunn, his alibi. And it's so clearly misogynistic and it is so clearly injustice. And then for them to say, well, they did an investigation and our officers were cleared. The investigation was justified and thorough.
And there seems to be some sort of bias that that law enforcement has, and this, by the way, is going on in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, against college female students who drink, who are drunk. Hmm. That is sort of an automatic, like, well, you can't possibly be relied upon, even though there is security footage that we see. We see the security footage of Megan Rondini, who we're speaking about, going back to her apartment with these two guys with her, leering at her. This TJ Bunn, he's almost like, if you watch the video, he's almost like rubbing his hands together in glee and leering at her behind her as she's walking ahead of him and kind of elbowing his bro. So they go back to her apartment and then he takes her back to his house. She is drunk. She is not she is not in her right mind. And they take advantage of that. They take her away from her apartment. They take her to where she doesn't have a ride home. And she claims that she was raped and she tries to get home. And what happens? She's the one who the police go after.
Well, they just put it down to a consent issue, which again is one of the things that used to make me really angry, that would be immediately, I saw it in the Met all the time, well, it's just a consent issue. But she was clear that she didn't consent. Her toxicology, I'm sure, would have shown her to be over the limit. And I'm sure that there's possibly drugs involved there too. Her parents believed that she was drug raped. So if the police go in with this attitude that if there's alcohol or drugs involved, it's just a consent issue, then is all they're doing is green lighting rapists, right, serial rapists, and allowing them to exploit vulnerable girls and women. And that's what's going on, because we know that there's a 1% conviction rate. And all these attitudes that we see on camera, and I've seen it for my 27 years, are the reason why only 1% are convicted, and serial perpetrators are just greenlit time and time again. And I do just want to say that her father, Michael, and mother, Cindy, sued the university and the therapist, and they won, but they also sued TJ Bunn, and there was a settlement, but Cindy wasn't alive to see that because she died in 2019.
Right.
And I'm sure it's all interconnected, because when you live with stresses like this, when you expect justice, you expect the right things to happen, when something horrific happens to your family member, your daughter, your son, and yet you see the exact opposite, it is just almost impossible to live with that. You know, that outcome of your daughter being stigmatized and being seen as the problem, when if you've never had contact with law enforcement at all, you would never think that was a possibility.
Right. And Laura, it's actually the presence of alcohol that should indicate to the cops that consent was not possible, not the opposite. Why the inverse is their conclusion? Why? They should be grilling them about how could you do this with her if you knew she had imbibed alcohol. That's the fact. That's how these investigations should go. Anybody who actually knows anything about these kinds of date rapes or rapes of people that where they meet in a bar where there's alcohol, it reduces the ability to consent. It does not increase it.
Exactly. And there are perpetrators who very well know that. And that's why they target girls and women in bars. It should be exactly that as a risk factor. But yet we saw it in the Met. We've seen it across policing, across the US and across the UK. It's seen as a way of screening out cases. If there's any issue of alcohol, drugs or mental health, those cases are screened out immediately. But this is much, so much more than that, because they are interacting with the victims. They are putting words in their mouth. They're bullying them. They're coercing them. We talked about Amanda Knox, didn't we, of her being kept and interviewed throughout the night. And in the end, her just saying she just gave up. And we know with girls and women, they're much more likely to fawn and collaborate and just tell someone what they want to get out of a situation. And here you've got girls and women who've been raped by a man, and then you've got a man using their presence, their physical presence, saying they're not believed, making them feel incredibly uncomfortable. And I think some of the covering up, Lisa, is about that feeling of being having been raped and feeling very uncomfortable with a lone man in the room who's giving them this awful interrogation and using tactics, as Jim said, that should be used on hardened perpetrators who you know are lying, and you're trying to get a confession from them, or you're trying to catch them in a lie,
right,
not with young traumatized women. This profile of 16 to 26 year olds who are malleable, you try and do that to a 47 year old woman, you'll probably get a very different response. And I suspect they know that. They know that.
It's clear. I mean, the Reid technique is literally used for criminals. It is not. In fact, it has come under a lot of fire since it's been implemented, and it can result in false confessions. But this, again, is a false recantation. You're not supposed to be using it against victims of crimes. You're supposed to be taking the complaint, investigating, getting all the information possible, and attempting to make an arrest of the perpetrator, not trying to make it go away and then flipping the scales and making an arrest of the victim. It's outrageous.
You know, at one point of the documentary, Jim and Laura, Rachel DeLeon, the investigating reporter, she sits down face to face with one of these detectives to try to ask him about the Reid technique. And this is Detective Cotto, who was instrumental in getting a woman who claimed to be raped prosecuted for a false rape claim. And he's very proud to talk about the Reid technique and his technique of actually touching the victim while he's talking to her. I just found that absolutely
revolting. Well, it's offensive in a revolting sexual assault and rape case.
But one thing I want to say about Rachel's, her approach, I don't know, Laura, if you clocked this or not, but Rachel's approach to talking to him, I thought was very interesting. You know, she dressed very casually. She dressed almost like a college student herself when she was interviewing, where in other times you see her, she's like in a suit and a blazer, but she made herself very soft and unassuming and unthreatening, almost, I don't want to say flirting, you know, but she was very like, oh, really? Tell me more about that. Tell me how you get people to talk. You know, he was so flattered by her interest in him. And it up until the point when she says, oh, well, by the way, did you know that this the person that this victim accused of raping her also had another person accuse him? And the minute she did that, he like freaks out. He like really gets very uncomfortable and stiffens up and suddenly is like, So I thought that her approach to him was really, really interesting. She didn't come at him like we've seen other investigative journalists, you know, really being forceful and exerting any kind of status at all. She really came under the wire and just got him, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think she had to. And, you know, Detective Wilberto Cotto Jr., let's name him fully, this man made my skin crawl. Appealing to his ego, absolutely, you could see he wanted it to be the show about him and about what a great detective he was, when actually I would say the absolute opposite is true. Her technique was absolutely the right one to play, and she obviously had this card, which was that she knew that the perpetrator, well, two perpetrators, but one of them had a history, and he had a history of rape. And when she put it to him, he didn't know about that. That's when you see him, like you said, come unstuck, and his stuttering and his stammering. And he said initially he knew, then he said, wait, hang on. And then he wanted to go and check. And what it told me was that he didn't do an investigation at all.
No.
And her play was the right one in the sense of, the fact that she couldn't get any police officers on the record was probably the big problem with the documentary. But the fact that they didn't go on the record tells me that they can't defend the indefensible. They cannot defend the indefensible. This is absolutely outrageous what we're seeing and what we're hearing. And then this detective thinks that this is all about him doing a great job when he is touching a rape victim. And he's moving his body into her, and he's saying that she's a pretty lady, a smart lady. I have to say, I just felt the pit of my stomach was, I just felt sick watching that. They are not tactics that you would ever, ever employ with a victim that's traumatized. And in the UK, you can't do this shit, by the way. There's peace, which was pace. There are rules and regulations. You cannot do this shit. You cannot lie to victims. You were meant to be the beacon of integrity. And yes, you want people to confess. But doing this when we know in 2023 that women, when there's a threat or a stressor, we don't always fight or have flight. We fawn and collaborate. We say what needs to be said, particularly to appease men who are coming onto us or invading our personal space. And we just want to get out of the room. Most women would probably say anything. So this guy, this detective being put under the microscope and being asked about that, and he's a guy who is literally green-lighting rapists. That's what he's doing. And I'm glad that she did get him on camera, and I'm sure it didn't turn out the way that he wanted it to. But I also just want to mention to you, Jim and Lisa, that Nikki Jovino, who we're talking about, she was sentenced to 1 year behind bars, and that's on him. He did that. But she would have got an extra 5 years for asking for a rape exam kit. And I just find that unbelievable. you know, that we're seeing that women going to prison for more than what we're seeing male stalkers, domestic violence perpetrators,
and rapists.
Rapists. And yet women are getting slapped with these sentences by detectives using tactics that should never be used on vulnerable and traumatized young women.
Well, we have so much more to discuss about these particular cases and the victim suspect documentaries on Netflix. It's an amazing documentary because it blows open why only 1% of sexual assault rape cases actually end up in conviction. This is a broken system. This is an abused system. And we're going to get more into it next week on Real Crime Profile. Till then, this is Real Crime Profile signing off.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.